Today's episode of Living Downstream is a recording of our panel discussion, Teaching Kids About Climate Change. Enjoy!
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for our panel discussion this evening, Teaching Kids About Climate Change. We'll start out with a land acknowledgement. We acknowledge that the land where the Umpqua Watershed is located was historically occupied and tended by various Indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Kokwel, Malala, and others. Their story is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity toward the natural environment, which Indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. This evening, your event is hosted by both Umpqua Watersheds and the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. So I will have people from both of those organizations introduce themselves and tell a little bit about each organization. So from Umpqua Watersheds, besides myself, we also have Casey Hovick and Angela Jensen. So Casey, if you'd like to share a few words about Umpqua Watersheds before we move on to Stuart from Douglas County Global Warming Coalition.
Sure. Thanks for having us in organizing this. Ryan, we're really proud to have our guests with us tonight. Umpqua Watersheds was first formed in 1986 as a volunteer organization for citizens to help monitor public forest and watershed management projects. And we obtained our 501(c) status in 1995. Since that time, with the support of hundreds of households in Douglas County and thousands of volunteer hours, Umpqua Watersheds now includes two staff members and an AmeriCorps. We also have a radio station. And the growth of Umpqua Watersheds has resulted in increased public input for forest and watershed management problems and solutions. This visibility has produced a greater understanding within the community of what it means to be a conservationist. By the hard work of so many in the past and present and those coming in the future, Umpqua Watersheds is now a living organization with the ability to survive and benefit all of our community. So really, our mission is dedicated to the protection and restoration of the ecosystems of the Umpqua Watershed and beyond through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship, as well as outreach. So our education programs, like the one we're having tonight, are essential to doing the work that we're doing for the Umpqua Watersheds and beyond. Now, I'd also like to introduce Angela Jensen.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Angela Jensen. I am the Conservation and Legal Director for Umpqua Watersheds. I've been serving in this capacity for 2 years and very excited and very happy to be a part of this awesome team as we move forward with our conservation goals and educating our community and moving forward with our watershed protection. And just very excited, very happy to be here. And thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you both. All right, now we'll move on to Stuart Leibowitz with the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. If you can share a little about yourself and your organization.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank our guests for sharing their expertise on this very important subject. Douglas County Global Warming Coalition has been active in our community for 19 years. We are an all-volunteer organization that has a membership of approximately 500 residents. And in addition to our legislative work, we have held numerous forums over the year, including Dr. Jane Lubchenco, the former head of NOAA, and Dr. Philip Moat, who was a contributor to the IPCC. But most pertinent to this particular evening is the work of our Children's Trust of Oregon, which instituted a lawsuit on behalf of children to try and force the federal government to take action based on specific legal theories. And we were on the ground floor and had in one of our forums Professor Mary Wood, who was the architect of the legal theory, as well as Kelsey Juliana, who is one of the key plaintiffs in that regard. So I view this particular forum as an extension and building on the foundation of the type of work that is so critical to making sure that our children grow up not only understanding climate, but also becoming the climate activists of the future. Again, thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Thank you for being here tonight, Stuart. Yeah, and if you're interested in our Children's Trust, you can check out their website. Also, I found out that there is a video on Netflix that is about their struggle and their story. I think it's called Youth v. Government or something like that. All right, so as Stuart mentioned, we're very excited to have our panelists with us tonight. So I'll just briefly introduce them, and then in a little bit, they'll have a chance to introduce themselves and tell a little bit more about themselves. But as a brief intro, we have Ian Shanahan, Editor-in-Chief for Green Teacher, as well as Nadia Harview, Associate Director for Educational Programs with the Finger Lakes Institute. So I just briefly want to go through our plan for this evening. We'll take a poll, and then we will have the panelist presentations, as well as go through a few prepared questions. There'll be another poll thrown in there as well. And then also, if there's time, we'll do some audience questions, or if the other hosts want to present any questions to the panelists before we wrap things up. So the first poll is coming at you now, and this relates to your comfort level. So we're wondering how comfortable all of you are with teaching kids about climate change. One, I am not at all comfortable teaching kids about climate change. Two, I'm kind of uncomfortable teaching kids about climate change. Three, neither comfortable or uncomfortable. Four, I'm moderately comfortable teaching kids about climate change. Five, very comfortable. So as you read those, you can answer those. I'll give it a couple more seconds. All right, and so it looks like a couple of our participants are moderately comfortable, so they answered four. No one answered one or two, so at least people are looking like they're kind of comfortable or pretty comfortable. So we had the one person answer three and one person answer five as well. So moderately comfortable to potentially comfortable. So, all right, we'll jump back into another poll later, but you can see those results there if you're interested. All right, so at this point, I'd like to switch to the panelist presentations. So each panelist will have an opportunity to share a little bit about what they do relating to climate change. So we'll start first with Ian and then go to Nadia. So Ian, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Ryan. And a real pleasure to be here and to be invited back. I believe it was, I forget exactly what time of the year it was back in 2021 when I was here the first time, but it's a great pleasure to be back alongside Nadia and all the rest of you. And I am wearing the hat this evening, or this afternoon, if you're joining us from Pacific time, I'm wearing the hat of Green Teacher, which is a nonprofit organization with charitable status in Canada. We are based in Canada, actually started in Wales in 1986 when I was 1 year old. So I had nothing to do with the origins of Green Teacher. I'm just carrying on a tradition that was started by a gentleman by the name of Damien Randall and carried on by Tim Grant and Gail Littlejohn when the North American branch opened in 1991. Green Teacher for many years was strictly a quarterly magazine, and that was back in the days when magazines were actual hard copy items made of paper that you could pick up and flip through. Now we're fully digital and have taken on more of the resource portal approach in continuance with industry standards. So we do more than just the magazine now. We do a lot of professional development, particularly around climate change education and biodiversity education. We do a series of free webinars. We have a podcast talking with green teachers, and we also have several books, including Teaching Kids About Climate Change, which is the title of this workshop tonight, and Teaching Teens About Climate Change. And each of those books serves essentially as a toolkit for teaching about climate change in solutions-focused, hands-on, interactive ways. And that will be a big part of the focus here today, is talking about best approaches to climate change education. And there isn't a one size fits all. I mean, this is an issue with a tremendous amount of complexity. And maybe I'll start with a little story to illustrate a potential entry point into a lesson about climate change, as well as an illustration of the complexity of it. So I see that Casey is wearing, I believe it's a Minnesota Twins hat. Is that correct? So I'm deducing from that he is a baseball fan. And I too am a baseball fan, a Toronto Blue Jays, having grown up about an hour and a half east of Toronto. However, as I was growing up, the Blue Jays, for the most part, weren't very good. They won a couple World Series when I was very young. And then they went through a period of about 20 years when they didn't even make the playoffs. And in the year 1998, there was a lot happening in Major League Baseball. It was the great home run race between Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, which during my birthday party, Mark McGwire broke the record. He hit home run number 62 on September 8th, 1998. However, for those who have followed the history of baseball, they will know that there is a rather large asterisk beside all of the home runs hit by most anybody in that period of baseball history, including Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, the alleged breakers of Roger Maris's record from 1961, which, interestingly enough, was 61 home runs. But before I get too far down into a baseball rabbit hole, I think the baseball metaphor in the steroid era works fairly well in terms of climate change, because climate change is climate on steroids, just as so many of those men were baseball players on steroids. And anytime there is a storm, a drought, a fire, a serious hurricane, we can't say with absolute certainty that, yes, that specific storm, that specific drought or heat dome or wildfire or flood was definitively caused by climate change. Just as we can't definitively say that the home run that Mark McGwire hit on September 8th, 1998, off of Steve Traxel of the Chicago Cubs, we cannot definitively state that he hit that home run because he was on steroids. Maybe he hit the home run because he had good form. Maybe he saw the pitch very well. There are many variables involved in this, of course, and it's much the same way when it comes to extreme weather events. What we can say for certain, and the data, of course, backs this up, is that the occurrence of extreme weather events has increased significantly and is continuing, unfortunately, in an upward direction. So I use that example, one, because storytelling can be an effective entry point into any sort of lesson, because we understand the world through stories. To quote George Monbiot, or to paraphrase George Monbiot, a gentleman who's written a tremendous amount about climate change and rewilding, a fellow from England, the world is so complex and issues like climate change are so complex that we need stories and we need narratives to tell. And I fear that we don't necessarily, and I can at least speak from the Canadian side of this, although I do have my finger on the pulse across North America, I feel like we don't tell enough good stories about what we could achieve. And this, I think, speaks to another area of complexity, whereas on one hand, we need to focus on solutions. And in the realm of climate change education and the scholarship that's being done on this, just time and time again, people are saying we need to focus on solutions. We need to focus on solutions. And part of that is we need to tell better stories. We need to envision a future where we got it right and dare ask that question, what if we do figure this out? And there's a really interesting image that I think could gain a lot of attention and certainly has in certain circles gained a lot of attention. And that's the image of solar punk. And that is two words jammed together, solar and punk. And it seems a bit idiosyncratic at first, but it's essentially envisioning a future that's a bit offbeat, hence the punk, in the sense that it is a break from the current business as usual, the current establishment, but not in an aggressive or dismissive way, just in a very practical, hands-on way where we figure out a society where we wire our energy system based on electricity, powered by renewables primarily, and that we've adopted principles of biomimicry that folks like Janine Benyus have written so much about and Paul Hawken has done some work with as well. Why don't we tell stories about that? Why don't we have climate fiction, or cli-fi as it's called, where we talk about a future where we sorted it out, where we reached our Paris targets, where we reached the 1.5, which is very unlikely at this point. It is possible, but it's very unlikely. Now, the 2 degrees mark is still would be a challenge to get there, but it's more possible. Right now, we're trending more towards a 3 degrees future, but a lot of researchers are calculating social feedback loops. And Catherine Hayhoe just shared out an article about this recently, that social feedback loops and adoption and the falling price of renewables could get us more in that 2 degree range, low twos. I mean, let's be honest, anything above zero is problematic. We're already at approximately 1.2, and that's obviously problematic. Look what's just been going on in India and Pakistan. But yet we do need to tell better stories, but we need to toe the line between telling these better stories and focusing on solutions and not falling too much into the trap of techno-optimism, which has a lot of false promise. And even folks who have done a lot of good work, like Bill Gates, he absolutely has done a lot of good work, but he has really doubled down on this idea of bioengineering as a solution. We've already seen bioengineering, the Beijing Olympics in 2008, they used bioengineering to make sure that the skies were clear. That, of course, happened on a smaller scale. the large-scale bioengineering that's being talked about by folks like Bill Gates has so many variables involved. And when we're already dealing with a very complex system, it's so risky. And it ultimately plays into the hands of the defenders of the status quo, the business as usual crowd who just say, let's sit back, burn as much oil as we can, use the oil wealth to innovate our way out of this trouble. And it just doesn't work that way. Could it possibly work? Is there a parallel universe where that could work out? Maybe. But is that a risk that we're willing to take, at least just based on the precautionary principle? I mean, nobody weighing all of the options would choose that as the logical path forward. So we have to be really careful about falling into that techno-optimist lane, because it just lets big oil off the hook. But we still have to tell these stories about real solutions that we have. And we can tell stories about how in Texas, for example, I mean, the oil heartland of the US, wind and solar resources are tremendous, and wind and solar prices have come down so much that Texas is now a leader in wind and solar. That's an example of a true story that we can tell, that people can get excited about. Now, the next challenge is making this relevant to people. I'm based in Ontario, I'm near Toronto. What's happening in Texas, I'm certainly interested in, but the average person might not care about the price of electricity powered by renewables in Texas. It's what's happening to the electricity grid where I am based. And I know Nadia is going to speak about making local connections and empowering students, which is certainly a big part of what we need to do. And again, the scholarship about climate change education says that we need to make it local, we need to make it relevant. And combining that with a focus on solutions is how we can empower students and give them agency, which is also a way to combat eco-anxiety. And there have been so many wonderful books written about this, about actually facing those emotions and dealing with those emotions. And I mean, this is just like human psychology. If you're going through something, you have to face it. And it's actually quite a reasonable reaction to feel a tremendous sense of dread and gloom when looking into the climate future, because even if we reach our Paris targets, that will still come with it many, many, many challenges and disruptions. So it's hardly an irrational reaction to feel down or blue because of this. So a lot of folks like Britt Ray, who just produced a book called Generation Dread, are talking about the fact that we need to face these emotions. But in the process of facing these emotions, find means to take action. And that's where the local connection comes in. And I think that's a perfect transition point over to some of what Nadia will be touching on.
Thanks, Ian. That is perfect, actually. So hi, everyone. I'm Nadia Harview. I am the Associate Director for Educational Programs at the Finger Lakes Institute, and we're part of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in beautiful Geneva, New York, on one of the Finger Lakes called Seneca Lake. The Finger Lakes Institute is dedicated to education, outreach, and research about our 11 Finger Lakes and the watersheds that surround them. We have a couple of different program areas: research, education, outreach, and supporting sustainable economic development. So I've been with the Finger Lakes Institute since 2013, and I have a long history of being involved in environmental education. Casey, when you were talking about the watershed organization, it sounds very familiar to one of the watershed organizations I've been a longtime volunteer for since 2006, Canandaigua Lake Watershed Association. And we do a lot of community science, education, programs like this one. And so I'm really pleased to be part of the presentation tonight. So the programs that I run are really centered around community science, sometimes called citizen science or participatory science, and also taking some sort of action. So getting students and young people involved in their local environment, studying the local environment, caretaking for their local environment, getting the training to become good stewards about their environment. So we have a program called Science on Seneca, where students go out on our research vessel and learn about water quality of lakes. We have our stream monitoring program, where we train teachers and students to use their local streams or rivers as their outdoor classroom, whether it's on their school property or nearby in a park or in somewhere in their community. We do service learning projects in the community that help, you know, kind of improve the environment. So stream restoration type projects, storm drain marking projects. I also run professional learning for educators. And then the last program that I kind of skipped over, but is so relevant for tonight, is the Finger Lakes Youth Climate Summit that we run here annually. So we started this program in 2017. That was our first year. It's a one-day conference for high school students to convene, learn about climate change, and then come up with a climate action plan. And this is where the students can identify a need either in their school, in their school district, in their community, and make a plan to work towards a solution. So Ian, as we're talking about solutions, this is exactly what we're talking about for young people. And a lot of this can be applicable to any age student. So I'll talk about that a little bit more. Each year we've had a different theme for our Youth Climate Summit. In 2018, our theme was sustainable food systems. If you're not familiar with Western and Central New York, one of our biggest economic drivers is agriculture. So that's one of the really important industries here. And a lot of farming families were primarily a rural community, and it's pretty amazing here. And then we also, in 2019, we had a theme promoting water security through science. And that was kind of a response to some of the science deniers about climate change at the time. So we were very excited to be putting that forth. And then during the pandemic, we really focused on ways that students could continue to be involved in activism on digital platforms, obviously, because everything was shut down for a time period. I really want to give a big acknowledgement to the Wild Center, which is located in the Adirondack. The Wild Center is a science museum and nature center. They started the Youth Climate Summit model over 10 years ago, maybe now 15 years ago. And they've created a toolkit for anyone to start this type of program. And the way we started this program is that we had a student from the Adirondacks who participated in the summits at the Wild Center as a high school student. And then she was a student at the college at Hobart and Williamson Colleges and said, this would be a great place to host the summit. And so we started the summit. The Wild Center has great resources on their website. I really encourage anyone to check it out and, you know, connect with them if you're interested in learning more. So I just wanted to share some lessons learned over these last several years of working with students on climate activism. And so the four things that I just wanted to touch on are supporting youth as leaders. They are our future, and we have to make way for them and support them as leaders, give them the tools that they need and also the space to have their voices heard. And so I think that's one of the great joys of doing this kind of work is helping them lift up their voices and their visions for the future. Also wanted to just touch on different types of individual and collective actions. Certainly place-based relevance. I have a couple of examples of climate action plan projects that school groups did here in our region. And then because I am trained as a geologist and, you know, we know that science is really important when we're looking at climate change and long-term trends, really looking at opportunities to engage youth in community science at any age, really. So supporting youth as leaders, this is, you know, developing leadership skills is something that's really important. We have in our Youth Climate Summit model, we have a team of youth who, you know, want those leadership opportunities, and they'll be part of our planning team for our summit. They'll identify different topic areas that we're going to cover. They also identify the theme for our summit. They help network and create community with the other youth that participate. and they run our social media, which is awesome. So they're really great at that. You know, one of the things in our first summit that we got feedback on, we tried to cram so many different things in our one-day conference. The students really wanted time to network with one another and learn from one another. And so some of the groups that came to our summit didn't have any experience with any climate activism at all. And so they came with questions. And then there were a lot of groups that had a lot of experience. And so they shared different projects that they've worked on, different campaigns that they've worked on, and then just provided tips and support. And so, you know, these high school students are extremely capable. They're really motivated and they want to learn from one another. So that kind of peer support is another form of leadership that I think is really outstanding if you can find opportunities to do that. One last thing I'll just say about supporting youth as leaders. So at any age, I think it's really important to kind of take a little bit of a step back as an educator and make space to listen and to have the students identify some of the things that they're most passionate about. And so finding ways that you can support that, I think, is really important. So as part of our summit, we have the school groups create their climate action plans, which can vary greatly. So these can be based on individual or collective actions. Some of the school groups that came to us didn't even have an environmental club, so that was their very first action that they took. And I do know of local schools that have green teams or green clubs all the way down to elementary age students. So for whatever age group you're working with, you know, having some sort of like environmental team or club or action group is really great. This other group here, you know, wanted to start a composting program in their school. It was really interesting because one year there were several schools that wanted to start composting in their district, or well, actually in their building. And not all of them got approved by the school district. It was a tough learning experience for some of those kids to be turned down. There was a lot of reality checks about how processes work. And so that was pretty interesting. This group from Webster Thomas, their group really wanted to get involved in local government. And they campaigned at the county offices for climate action planning at the municipal level and did a great job of getting the word out and making sure this was front and center as an issue. You know, another thing that was really eye-opening when I first started this program is how few schools in our region had recycling programs. And I was honestly very surprised. So one of the schools that I worked with, you know, started a recycling program that included a lot of education and outreach of their peers, you know, what can be recycled, what shouldn't be recycled, and then also like trash pickups and things like that. So definitely, you know, you just never know what your school or your community might need. And all of those things kind of build together. Place-based relevance is really important, identifying local issues and then thinking about some of the solutions. For those of you who are listening in, I'm sharing a picture of one of our beautiful Finger Lakes. It's very forested here, landscape, but in the forefront of the picture is one of the vineyards, our areas, really well-known, well, maybe not well-known outside of New York, but it's a wine-producing and grape-growing region. So we have a lot of wineries here, but also a lot of growers who grow for Welch's. And one of the issues that, you know, we're facing here is invasive species. And as climate changes, we see the migration of invasive species into climates that they previously hadn't inhabited. We have hemlock woolly adelgid, which threatens the hemlock trees. Those are found primarily in kind of the steep slope gullies that are draining into the Finger Lakes. And, you know, losing all those trees would really impact our water quality. But the spotted lanternfly is an agricultural pest that really can kill off vineyards pretty quickly. Also, you know, any sort of like fruit producing trees. We also are home to a lot of apple orchards, very much like the Pacific Northwest, I would have to say. And so doing some outreach with younger students about how to identify these pests to be part of that early detection is really important. So we created these model spotted lanternfly bugs through these maker kits, and it was pretty cool. So that was a really fun younger age group activity that we did. We also, unfortunately, are home to some of the largest landfills in New York State here in the Finger Lakes region. Seneca Meadows is the largest landfill in New York State. Ontario County is close behind. These both are within, you know, a few miles of Geneva where I work, and I see them both on my commute every day. They're also located very close to some of our schools, and that was a big issue for one of the schools that I worked with. They wanted to do a waste reduction campaign to reduce how much was going from the school to the landfill. Another school actually ended up doing an air quality monitoring program and awareness campaign because the methane that's released, you know, there's a lot of odors that end up being nuisance odors, and there wasn't really a clear way to report those violations of air quality. So they started a campaign to educate the public about that, which was great. So then the last thing I'll just say before I know we're going to move into questions is engaging youth in community science. I firmly believe that getting kids of all ages, even big kids like us, you know, adults, involved in action is really one of the best paths forward to stewardship. And so learning about your environment hands-on and caretaking for it by collecting data is critically important. So these are a couple of examples of stream sampling. There's also a lot of different programs out there that you can find that might fit your community better, might fit your age group better. Maybe you want to do something with pollinators and monarch butterflies. Project Budburst is a really cool phenology program where you can track the timing of different life cycle stages of plants, like when things bloom. The Coco Ras is a community pale rain and snow network. So you can set up a monitoring station at your school. eBird has a really neat program to track the timing of migration of different birds. So there's just so many different things that you can do out there for any age group to engage youth in community science. So these were just a few of my kind of favorite things when I was thinking about what would I share with somebody who wants to teach kids about climate change. And really what's pleased me so much is in the last 10, 15 years, I feel like climate change is definitely more out in the open as far as the public conversation. I started out my teaching career actually in Washington State, so I love the Pacific Northwest, but I also taught community college environmental science. And at the time, nobody was talking about climate change in the public realm, at least not here in New York State. And now it's a common topic that people are discussing. And so we are making progress. And I think that's keeping the conversation going is really important. So this is part of it. Ryan, thank you for organizing this and for the invitation from everyone.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Ian and Nadia, for sharing information about yourselves and your organizations and some great ideas. I'm going to start off the Q&A portion of our program with a few questions kind of based on questions and thoughts and ideas or requests that were submitted in the registration form. If either of you want to answer, you can kind of jump in. So the first question that we'll start with is specifically about, you know, specific examples of activities. So can you share some specific examples of activities that are effective? And let's start at the elementary level. So effective for children at the elementary level. And then after we've shared a few of those, we can jump on to middle school and high school as well. So elementary activities.
I can jump in with an example. This is from the Green Teacher book, Teaching Kids About Climate Change, and sort of borrowing from David Sobel's quote, no tragedies before fourth grade. We're not going to get into the gloom of extreme weather events with really young children, but we can expose them to the wonder of nature, including aspects of it that are directly connected to climate change, such as the carbon cycle. And there's this really wonderful activity created by an educator named Pam Miller from Toronto, and it's called Caught Up in the Carbon Cycle. And the way it works is that you have seven stations, and each station represents a different destination or landing spot for a carbon molecule. So you have an animal station, an atmosphere station, combustion, plant, rock cycle, carbon cycle, soils, rock cycle, and water. And each round, students who are participating, they take on the role of a carbon molecule, and they pick up different cards that tell them what they're going to do next. So for example, if they're in a plant card and the plant gets burnt in a forest fire, they then go to the atmosphere station. And students can actually track their progress on a passport card or map out where they're going. And I think there's such a great opportunity to make an activity like this place-based, where instead of calling the stations generic things like water station, animal station, give it a specific Finger Lake. If you're doing this in the Finger Lakes, have a specific iconic tree for the plant station, an iconic animal species for the animal station, and so on and so forth, to really ground it in that local place. You can do this outside. Kids are running around. They're having a great time. They get this positive association that, oh, by the way, we just learned about the carbon cycle, which of course is a foundation to understanding about climate change, which they'll progressively learn about throughout childhood. So that's always one that I billboard as such an engaging, place-based, hands-on activity that can of course be done outdoors, that really is developmentally appropriate and really sets the groundwork for what students are going to learn later.
I love that activity, Ian. That's really cool. I saw an activity last year that I was really interested in called Forest of Promises. And this was the World Wildlife Federation was doing kind of an educational campaign around COP26. So a conference of parties, the United Nations Climate Conference. And so they had students or the teachers download different shapes of leaves, and then the students cut them out. On one side, they made their own promise to the environment. And on the other side, they had a request for the government, you know. And at the time, it was for the delegates who were at COP26. But you could do this today with even your local government. So I thought that was a really great way of thinking about civic responsibility and action and connecting kids to the civic process and finding a way for their voice to be heard too. And then the way they shared that was a couple of different ways. They did shared the individual leaves on social media, but also they made this mural with like the tree and then all the leaves that made up the tree. And I thought that was just really sweet. So I really like that connection to with the civic engagement and kind of lending your voice to the process, even at a young age.
Awesome. Thank you both for those ideas. So I think those are mostly elementary. Are there any middle school and or high school level, in case we have people listening who maybe work with older students or have older kids that they're trying to reach?
I can give another example. This is from the Teaching Teens About Climate Change book from Green Teacher, and it's teaching about carbon regulations. So, you know, no tragedies before fourth grade, but once you get into high school, not necessarily get into tragedies, but get into the more nitty-gritty of policy. And this activity involves a simulation of three different scenarios. One is a command and control, just a very top-down, you know, taking a war footing and saying, this is what we're going to do, and there's really no other way around it. And then the two other systems are a carbon tax system, and you can set the rate at whichever you determine, and a cap and trade system, which of course would require a bit of additional explanation. And you would split the class into groups, and each group would take on the identity of a fictitious but realistic utilities company that's powered largely by a fossil fuel. And then you simulate through each of these scenarios, and you look at what would be the CO2 or CO2 equivalent impact, as well as the economic impact for your organization at short, mid, and long-term scale. So sort of 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, 20 year kind of thing. And this is a great way to look at the policy decisions and picking up on what Nadia talked about, civic engagement. Well, to get involved in civic engagement, getting close to the voting age, you need to have an idea of what some of these policy mechanisms are. And this is a great way to do it. And this is a very empowering activity because it's deeply personal to students. You know, how would this affect the bottom line? How would this affect the air in your community? So that's a really, really strong one that we recommend from our Teaching Teens book.
Thank you. Yeah, I was thinking also, jumping back just to something that Nadia, you mentioned earlier, the Youth Climate Summit. I was thinking, oh, we should start something like that in Oregon. And it's kind of similar to our Eco Innovations Challenge that we held last year, which offered an opportunity for youths and adults to suggest solutions to local environmental challenges. Mm-hmm. And then we actually have done a couple of those projects, right? We supported one called Kids for Nature, which is a youth-led program for other youths, basically a summer program, but it gets kids out in nature, enjoying nature, learning about the environment, but then also creating nature art projects and different things. Yeah, so I liked some of the different ideas that you brought up before, as well as these ones that you're talking about now, Ian. And I have used, as a former teacher, I've used a lot of Green Teachers resources in my own classroom, so I can attest to their value. Okay, I think before we move to the next question, I'm just going to pose another poll. So this one is asking about challenges to teaching about climate change. What is the biggest challenge? And everyone who's participating, and if you're at home or listening later, you can think about the biggest challenge that you experience when teaching kids about climate change. So maybe it's feelings of negativity, despair, overwhelm on the part of the students. Maybe it's feelings of negativity, despair, overwhelm on the part of the teacher or the parent. Perhaps it's lack of tools, resources, support to implement lessons and activities. Maybe it's parental pushback or dismissal of the topic. I know that some of the questions that came in from registrants who either are attending tonight or may not be here at the time, but are going to watch the recording later, have expressed some anxiety about approaching certain parents who they know are going to push back, or the timber industry that has a big influence in Southern Oregon. Perhaps it's school administration pushback or lack of flexibility in being able to incorporate climate change into your classroom. All right, so I'll just give it another couple seconds if you haven't had a chance to answer that poll and want to answer it. All right, so it's looking like, so a couple of people have expressed some challenge with parental pushback or dismissal of the topic, teaching about climate change, as well as some people in attendance have feelings of negativity, despair, overwhelm about the enormity and complexity of climate change themselves, and or some pushback from school administration. All right, so my question then to the panelists and our hosts, if you also have some ideas as well, what are some challenges or pushback that you've encountered, and how did you combat those?
So in one of the recent workshops I did with teachers, one of the teachers said to me, how do you teach about climate change when people don't believe the science? And I think that's really common kind of response that people hear. One of the things that I often hear to support that argument is the fact that our planet in the past has been much warmer. And so that is true as far as like coming from a geologist standpoint. When you look at the entire history of our planet, there have been cooler periods, there have been warmer periods. However, there are no natural processes that can explain kind of the increase that we're seeing right now and the accelerated pace at which we are warming our planet. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that, yes, in our geologic past, there have been times where that may have been true, but that was also before there were people on the planet. So yeah, that's one of the things. And then the other thing that I just wanted to mention is that I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but students are sometimes surprised at how long it takes to work through any sort of project planning and implementation. And I think that's an eye-opening experience for them because they are so eager to see change happen. And it just can't happen at the pace that they want. And sometimes it's because they're just working in a system where perhaps your school board doesn't meet every week. You know, they're meeting once a month or once every other month. And so you have to, you know, prep for that opportunity, or maybe you're not going to get on the agenda. You have to wait until the next meeting. And that can be a source of frustration and a big challenge for students when they're thinking about moving things forward. But, you know, it's a good learning experience. They learn how to navigate it.
Thanks, Nadia. Ian, do you want to share anything on this question as well?
Yeah, I think time is certainly a big part of it when it comes to educators, particularly in the public school system where they are beholden to certain curriculum guideline expectations and their plate is already full and they just think, oh, not something else that I need to layer on top of it. And for this, I have to give tremendous credit to the work that they've done in New Jersey, where they became actually the first state in the U.S. to incorporate climate change education into all subject areas from K to 12. That was in June of 2020 when that happened, you know, a really momentous occasion. So that certainly is a systems level response to that challenge of there not being time. If it is in the curriculum, there has to be time for it. But if you are not in New Jersey or a jurisdiction, and I know Washington State as well has done a lot of work very similar to New Jersey in this way. If that is not an option, you need ready to go resources that you don't have to spend hours and hours researching. They have to be ready to go. And I mean, that's partly why we're here tonight, is to share activities and resources that work and that are ready to go, that educators can pick up and conceivably do with their students tomorrow without having to do even more prep on top of what they already do. And I just want to pick up also on the point that Nadia talked about, receiving pushback. I mean, we've all been there. We've all been in those conversations and they're really hard. There's just no two ways about it. They're incredibly difficult. I was reading in Catherine Hayhoe's book, Saving Us, that came out last year, about a study called Global Warming Six Americas that's done by the Yale Program on Climate Communication. And it categorized different reactions to climate change in six different groups, six different categories. And the dismissive group, the folks who are the ones that you're going to have those conversations with, who are going to flood subreddit posts and who are going to be listening to podcasts of conspiracy theories, they only make up about 9% of the population. Now, they seem like they're about 99% sometimes, especially when you're talking to one of them. And they all have their talking points in their script and they've got all the numbers down. But that to me was reassuring that that was such a small number and that the alarmed group was the biggest, 33%. It doesn't change the fact that when you're right there in the moment having one of those conversations, it's not incredibly difficult. And, you know, I thought Nadia gave a great example of a way that you can, I'll sound very Canadian with a hockey reference here, you can sort of stick handle around it, but there are some people that just aren't going to hear what you're going to say. And sometimes you just have to say, well, I have to teach what I have to teach and you don't have to agree with it, but I do have to teach it. And they can complain. They're welcome to complain, but they, of course, don't have a leg to stand on. It's a complaint that wouldn't hold any water.
Yeah, thank you for that feedback and those ideas, Ian and Nadia. So another question that came up a lot, and I think has probably come up in our, you know, discussions and preparations for this evening, how do we keep things positive? Where do you find hope amidst all the negativity and despair?
Okay, I'll take this one first. So I feel like that emotional response, Ian talked about this great in the beginning, you know, that the emotional response and, you know, feeling so many emotions about climate change and the weight of the issue and the impact is very natural. And I'm the sort of person who likes to move past that to the action, you know, like, okay, what are we going to do? And even if the action may be on a smaller scale, I think thinking about collective impact is really important, but also having some sort of kind of agency to move the process forward is really important for young people and to be involved. So finding ways to support that is really critical.
I could essentially reiterate everything that Nadia said there. I mean, it is really, really difficult to stay positive some days, and it's okay to admit that, and it's okay to spend time with those emotions. This is perhaps the biggest collective action problem that the world has ever faced. It's probably inarguable. Yet the IPCC is probably the biggest collective science project or science collective the world has ever seen. And that certainly gives a lot of hope. And with some of the commitments from COP26, and I think we all came away disappointed in a lot of ways from COP26, but with the agreements that were put in place, a lot of the worst case scenario options are off the table. And I know that doesn't change the fact that some very distressing options are still very much on the table. And it's important to recognize that. But the fact that, for example, what David Wallace Wells has written a lot about, the uninhabitable Earth, a lot of those scenarios are most likely not going to happen. And that's despite the best efforts of big oil and Murdoch media, you know, that whole empire. The fact that we've been able to make the progress that we have with renewables and electric vehicles, I mean, my goodness, the progress that's been made in that area, despite the billions of dollars that have been put into just trying to lie, does give a certain degree of realistic hope.
Thanks. I think Casey, you want to share something, and maybe Angela and Stuart also?
Yes, I believe that young people are essential to changing the narratives of how climate change is viewed. You can look at what Greta Thunberg was able to do with generating interest and passion towards addressing climate change. And we have something here in the Umpqua as well. In 2016, we had two students come to us and said, we can't hold our climate club at Roseburg High School. And they had a club called League of Umpqua Climate Youth, LUCY. And there were problems politically in the school district that they wouldn't allow them. So Umpqua Watersheds gave them space. And so Alex Losnack and Jacob LaBelle brought their club into Umpqua Watersheds. And so we all learned about what they were doing about climate change and help empower them. Alex went on to Columbia University for 4 years and now is at the University of Oregon studying environmental law. Jacob LaBelle was Umpqua Watershed's keynote speaker at our banquet in 2019. So these young people have brought our imagination to this. And my question then thrown out to you, how can we use young people and all the things they're doing? We've seen the marches, and I know Green Teachers involved in 75 different countries, bringing young people to the forefront to tell that positive story of how young people can make a difference in the climate war.
Yeah, you know, this goes back to this idea that we need to tell better stories. And Damon Gameau just came out with a documentary that the name escapes me, but Damon Gameau, G-A-M-E-A-U. And he's quoted in the afterword of Paul Hawkins' book, Regeneration, the follow-up to Drawdown. And he says exactly that. We need to, you know, have alternative narratives that are based in realistic hope. And sort of spoiler alert, Green Teacher and Umpqua Watersheds are in discussions about collaborating on a podcast series where we tell stories of young change makers and align those with each of the UN SDGs. And these are true stories of people who are making change and who are doing work out there and who also need help. And I think that's the exciting part of this, is that there are other ways to get involved, which is really exciting.
And I would just like to add, Ian, that Douglas County Global Warming Coalition are also our partners. They're the ones that have been on the ground for two decades. So they're part of this story. And I'm really excited that our three organizations are working together. And obviously we'll be reaching out to Finger Lakes too. We have a great collaborative here that we can look forward to moving forward.
Did any of the other hosts or attendees have other questions? I know, Stuart, you mentioned earlier you might have a question that you'd like to share or to ask the group.
Yeah, I'd like to direct this toward Ian. And first of all, I found it quite positive, your examples of the lessons that you formulated to teach students. But I want to be very specific in regards to your Green Teacher. Scientific American, one of the most recent editions, had a long article about how the gas and oil companies have successfully fought to keep even the mention of climate change out of textbooks. And the reason that's important is that Texas is one of the hubs of textbook distribution across the United States. So what I'm interested to ask you is, how do we get the green teacher methodologies into curriculum across the United States and as a viable alternative to what the Texas textbooks are omitting?
Your question comes at such a great time. So we're also in partnership. I mean, there's so many wonderful partnerships out there. So there's a social enterprise in southeastern British Columbia that's based on the Columbia Basin Environmental Education Network. And a branch of that is the nonprofit Outdoor Learning Store. And they provide sustainably sourced outdoor learning equipment and resources. And they're about to launch an outreach approach into the US. So they've done a lot of work in BC, they expanded throughout Canada, and as of August, they're going to be starting outreach into the US. And they're carrying all of Green Teacher's books in their nonprofit store, as well as a book by an organization called Natural Curiosity that's based out of the University of Toronto. And they focus largely on inquiry-based learning for children through an Indigenous lens. And they've worked directly with various Indigenous partners to bring this pedagogy to life in this book. So their book and our books are all going to be available. And we're actually doing a reprint of one of our original books of Teaching Green the Elementary Years and reaching out across the US starting in August. So we're really, really excited about that. And as I say, the timing of your question is just bang on. And, you know, I should say, you know, we're all in this together. It's a big cooperative. There's an organization in New Jersey called Subject to Climate that is providing open source educational resources about climate change education. And they're hoping to reach beyond the borders of New Jersey as well. They're just using that as a starting point. So we're in partnership with them, at least just as promotional partners. And we're in loose discussions about some other possibilities that we could get involved in down the road. So those are two on the cusp opportunities right in front of us.
Very exciting. Thank you.
All right. Casey, did you have another question that you wanted to pose to the group before we wrap up?
I just want to say thank you, Nadia and Ian, for all this information. And you two are an important energy source for this world because of the hard work you're both doing to make a difference. And I also want to give a shout out to Ryan. She was our AmeriCorps last year. She's now our Director of Education and Outreach. And then we also, tonight, we have Viviana Young, our current AmeriCorps, and Jessica Saxton, our AmeriCorps for next year.
Thanks, Casey. Yeah, before we wrap up, so just a reminder, if you are listening later or watching now and you want to learn more, definitely check out the organizations of our panelists. So you can go to greenteacher.com or FLI, the Finger Lakes Institute's website, which is through the college. So Hobart William Smith, that's what HWS stands for. And we'll also be sharing out to all registering, as well as on our website, we'll share out a list of resources. Another opportunity locally in Douglas County for youth. So if you have a 7 to 12-year-old child or grandchild or niece or nephew or something who might be interested in doing a summer program, the program I mentioned earlier, Kids for Nature, is a great opportunity for them. They'll be visiting local parks, going on some hikes, collecting materials, creating different sorts of projects, as well as doing educational activities. It'll run Mondays and Tuesdays, July 11th to August 16th. So if you're interested at all, or if you're interested in facilitating, you can reach out to one of us. My email is Ryan, R-Y-A-N, at umpquawatersheds.org. So thank you all for attending. I am hoping that you'll join us again in a couple of months. On August 17th, we're going to be having another educational climate change event that has to do with the impacts on pollinators, insects, macroinvertebrates, that sort of thing. Again, thank you to our presenters. Thank you to the other hosts who are on this call. Thank you to the attendees. And I hope that, you know, everyone who is either present now or listens or watches later, please do share these ideas with other educators, other parents, and with the youth with whom you work. So I'm appreciative for everyone's energy and ideas. And yeah, let's do it.